The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We spoke yesterday about different systems and methods with regards to the study of Torah, and we're going to put one of them into practice. And I have to be honest with you, this is one of my favorite moments of it at Israelite, because I'm going to let you do a little work. And I want you to do something for me. First of all, open up your Chumashim. Now this, as you will immediately note, is the beginning of Exodus. Okay? And what I want you to do is real simple. Okay? I want you to take a look at the first chapter of Exodus. Now, let me just give you a few rules of engagement, okay? First, I want to remind you of what we've spoken about a couple times. What you're going to do first is just read it through. Get a sense of it. What's going on? I wouldn't take the time, for the purposes of our 15, 20 minutes, to break it down, but get a sense of it, okay? When you've done that, then go back through it and learn it. Now, you remember what I spoke to you about, what learning is. What bothers you? What challenges you? But there's a catch. Because now you're going to discover what real learning is. This is the way that they've been doing it for the last hundreds and hundreds of years. As a matter of fact, the oldest yeshiva in the world was closed in the year 1950 in Iraq. It was a yeshiva that had been established around the year 420 CE. It was a 1,600-year-old yeshiva. It was finally closed because of 1948 and the War of Israel and the Jews leaving Iraq. And this is the way that they have been doing it for the last 1,600 years in the world of yeshiva. You have to find a partner. You can't study alone. You're always going to miss something if you're studying alone. So pick a partner. If it doesn't work evenly, you can do it in a group of three. And what you have to do is you have to discuss what it is you're learning. What bothers you? What do you think? Share your ideas. If you disagree with each other, that's fine. Don't whisper. Okay, you can do this out loud. We'll take 20 minutes, okay, 15 to 20 minutes, to take a look at the story, to see what you think about it. So then I'm going to interrupt you, and we'll see what we can do with what we found. Okay, just the first chapter of Exodus. I will, by the way, point out to you that the first seven verses I'm not going to deal with. I think it's worth your reading them, and I preface reading and not learning, just to get the background. What we're really going to have fun with is verse 8 through 22. And only parts of that. Okay? So don't get stuck on the first seven verses. Got it? You'll see there's like a paragraph break, so it's very easy to spot what I'm talking about. And you're learning together. This partnership is called a chavruta. Okay? A study partner. I want to preempt two frustrations. Frustration number one is that of necessity, and by definition, given the time frame, and this wasn't something that I tell you now, it's something I knew in advance, we will not be able to get to all the issues you have raised. We will not even be able to raise the issues you have raised. Frustration number two is that you may feel, I'm just getting into something, and why are we stopping? This is what I'm enjoying. So I want to tell you something, if you feel that. This is how I feel every time I have to stop learning. It's very rare that I actually get to finish something and say, and sometimes it happens, okay, this is the time to take a break. Very difficult. That's actually a sign that you're really learning. Because how could you ever learn something of this nature in 20 minutes? In 2 hours? Where do you stop? Now, you haven't received anything from me. You've just been learning on your own, and you've discovered a little bit of what's already in you. I hope you realize, by the way, just as an aside, because sometimes people finish a program and they're like, well, I'd like to learn, but what do? That the answer's at your fingertips. You didn't need me to do this. You pick a story, just like I said yesterday, you find a friend, you sit and learn. It's that easy. Sometimes people don't realize how easy it is. So if you got a taste of that, I'll be happy. Having said all this, I want to add one more thing, which I meant to say yesterday. We led up to it, didn't get a chance to say it. We spoke a little bit yesterday about the Torah. Is the Torah divine? Is it not divine? We spoke a little about it in our question and answer session. We have certainly not resolved that issue, nor will we in the next 1,000 years. But I do want us to be able to communicate. You have gotten a sense already that at least my perception is that the Torah is divine. albeit that I don't expect anybody to accept that, and I'm quite happy when people disagree with me. But in order that we be able to continue these discussions, I want you to do something for me. This is not some charlatanry. This is just going to enable you to look at something through different eyes. And that's a very healthy thing to do. In general, when you can change your whole perspective and look at something differently for a while, that's a wonderful thing to do. So I want to ask you to do something. I don't want you to accept on my word that this is a divine book. That's not a healthy thing to do. But I want you to read it as though it's a divine book. In other words, pretend that you've gone through this process and that it's divine. How would you read it if it were divine? And as we continue these discussions, let's imagine for the moment that it is and talk about it from that perspective. Because if we're coming at it from two perspectives, we're just going to end up getting sidetracked on a lot of issues, which I will grant you are important, but then we'll be on many issues and not on one. So bear that in mind. If anybody finds that frustrating, come over and tell me. You don't have to do it. It's just a suggestion. But take a risk and try to read it as though it's divine for the next couple of weeks and see what it does for you. It's always a wonderful thing to look at a human being from a different perspective and all of a sudden to see things you didn't see before. That's wonderful. So to me, this book is not just a dry book. It's a living thing. And so, okay. Let me just, for 2 minutes, I won't get to all of them. Maybe I'm overestimating. But can you tell me some of the issues that came up? Some of what's going on here. Okay, I'm assuming, and if anybody doesn't feel they have a handle even on what the story is and what's being told here, then raise your hand now, because I'll be glad to. Yeah, okay, so we'll go through it. And then I want to hear what came up. All right, so we got a number of units. I'm breaking this down. I'll tell you what we'll do together, what I would do if I was studying this on my own with a partner. Unit number one is verse 1 to verse 7. These are the names of the children of Israel. By the way, note that that is a very important sentence because it's the first time you find the Jewish people called the Jewish people, even though you could translate it as the sons of Israel, of Jacob. But okay, so they come down to Egypt. They're coming down to Egypt because there's a famine in the land of Canaan. Joseph is the second in command. He's the vice president. It's a good place to be. Jacob, his family, all the names, they all get down to Egypt. Then there's a fascinating little addendum, the last two verses. Joseph dies, and all of that generation. In other words, we're now in a different generation. These are not now the generations of the children of Israel who knew Yaakov, whose member was way up high in politics. At the same time that this happens, the Jewish people are multiplying. They are... I mean, the Medrash and the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, does a play on words. It says, "Bnei Yisrael paru v'yishrutzu." They multiply like lizards, like vermins, like bugs. In other words, they're having births. There's a Medrash that says that every birth was actually sextuplets. Every time a woman gave birth, a Jewish woman gave birth, it was sextuplets. I can't imagine how anybody looks at that as a blessing, but some people are on a higher level than I am. However, right, as I mentioned before, these rabbinic legends, the issue is not whether they are literal or not, but what I'm meant to understand. There is something supernatural. There's something sort of unexplainable going on here. When you consider, notwithstanding those of you who are in the question and answer period, but if in fact, when the Jews leave Egypt, there are 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, meaning that there are approximately 3 million people. And if the Bible is quite clear that there are 70 people who go down, well, you do a little mathematics. How does 70 people turn into 3 million in 200 years? That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work. So the Medrash is making this point. So for the moment, I don't care how it happens.
Where'd you get the 300 million?
Not 300 million. That would really be incredible. 3 million. In other words, if there are 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60, and they all have families, so if the average family is 5, you have 3 million. Some commentary suggests it might have been maybe 12 or 13 million, which would be understandable, right? And there's one opinion that says it was 600 million. I mean, that's also not necessarily literal. Hang on a second. It doesn't really matter to me. It's a big number. Right. This is a small number. They're going to be a big number. It takes only 200 years. That's an eye-opener.
That okay? Number you gave was when they left Egypt. When they're in...
That number is when they leave Egypt. Right. Now, the Jews are in Egypt for 210 years. How I know that number, that's actually a textual number. It's in the text. You can ascertain it without actually being given it based on generations. And, you know, this person was born and then... When he was X number of years old, he had a child. You can figure it out. So there are miracles that we see quite obviously, like the splitting of the sea, and there are miracles we have to notice. That's a very healthy thing, to realize how many incredible events there are in our lives that we have to actually stop and notice. Right? It's not listed in the big miracle list, and yet it's there if you stop to look at it. Now again, you know, you could argue, did it happen or didn't it happen? The Torah would quite easily have quashed any doubts that might have arisen by not telling me that there were 70 people that went down to Egypt. The Torah doesn't do that. If, again, we're reading this as a divine book, so then that's not my issue. My issue is just to notice that it happened. Okay, so now they're in Egypt. And all of the hierarchy of the sons of Yaakov are gone. And a new king arises. And this new king, let's say, is not so happy with all these Jews. You know, like rabbits all over the country. Everywhere you look. I remember I once had a person, a fellow, who I had a lot of admiration for, until one Saturday night. We were walking on the west side, and a comment came out of his mouth that blew me away. And in the conversation that resulted from that comment, I realized that he really didn't realize what it was he was saying. We were walking on the west side. If you've been on the west side in the 80s on Broadway, you know there are a lot of fruit stores, a lot of vegetable stores, supermarket stores. You've been on the west side, right? Korean stores, you know, Asian stores, whatever. So we're walking down the west side, 81st Street, whatever it was, on a Saturday night from something. And they're all open at midnight. You know, to me, that's great. You know, you can buy whatever. And he says, God, everywhere you look, there are these Korean stores. So I understood his comment completely different. I said, yeah, you know, isn't it incredible? You know, very industrious, you know. He says, God, you know, they're taking over the neighborhood. And I looked at him, and I suddenly realized what he meant. So I said, well, does that bother you? So he looked at me, he said, well, no, because it's not my neighborhood. And then I understood that we were on two different wavelengths, right? So that's how power feels. And that's a problem. If the multiplication of a unit, of an ethnic unit, is a problem, then that's already a problem. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so power's got this problem. This is the first recorded racist in the Bible. Is that a fair statement? I mean, everybody, right? At least within the context. Okay, so power's got this problem, and he comes up with a solution. It's a pretty good solution. He says, listen, you know, 3,000 years later, the master race would have a similar dilemma. Killing 6 million Jews is a lot of work, and every bullet costs a lot of money. What are we going to do? That was power's problem. It's a lot of work. So then they say, and I'm just reading now the context of the verses. There are allegories and stories and midrashim and legends as to what's going on, and prophets foreseeing that there'll be a baby boy born. But forget all that, because we're studying verses now. If I have to kill all the baby boys and girls, that's a lot of work. Why don't we just kill the baby boys? Makes sense. If there are no baby boys, then it won't matter if there are baby girls. Plus, given the context of society, if I'm going to pick one sex to kill, kill the boys. Because I'm not worried. They didn't know about the Amazons and Wonder Woman yet. So they figured they'd be better off with all the women. And I could think of a lot of other reasons that they thought it was worthwhile to hang on to the women and kill the men. So, okay, so that's what power does. But then he does a strange thing, and he goes to these two midwives who seem to be Hebrews. We'll get to that too. And he says, listen, you are in charge of the nursing department of Egypt, right? You're the Jewish nursing department heads. That's what it seems. And so you're somehow involved in all of these birthings. So when you go, check it out. If it's a baby girl, slide around out, give him a birthday card. But if it's a baby boy, so then, you know, grab it and throw it in the river. I'll give you 2 cents a head. That's what Paro seems to be saying. And then these two women, and I'm purposely being rather extreme, because that's how I think these verses are presented to me. These women have some kind of a problem, and they don't do this. And that seems to be positive in the Bible. Is that a good synopsis, more or less, of what we're talking about? Mm-hmm. Okay? Okay. Now, having said that, what'd you come up with?
Why did they become slaves?
Ooh. Now, that's interesting. How did they, after all, become slaves if there's so many of them?
Right,
who made them slaves? Good. What else? Now, this is interesting. You pointed out, I think, something similar. What is this that they feared God? What is that? I mean, who was God? Where is God? How did they know God? Or did they have a relationship with God because they were Jews? And where was that? And what does it have to do with this? And what does fearing God have to do with not killing, etc.? Okay, what else? Now that's interesting. Okay. You're saying that this it's interesting that the language, paru vayirbu, is the exact same language as the language of the original commandment in Genesis, pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply. I've always, be honest with you, sort of wondered about that term, to be fruitful. I have to think about that. But a pre, the Hebrew word for pre, right, means that I have a tree, and the tree may be wonderful, but all of a sudden I have a fruit, and it means that I understand the purpose of the tree. So it's as though my purpose is to bring forth something beautiful into the world. So, okay. So they're doing what they were supposed to be doing. there isn't that much that people were given. Not, there are no Jews here yet. There isn't that much that people were given to do, and they were doing it. But of course, I don't know if that means anything because everybody was doing it, because that's how society survived. In fact, you could argue, why do I need a mitzvah that I'm going to do anyway? Everybody has children. Of course, then again, we live in a society where that's not necessarily true, so that's interesting. Okay.
So maybe that's the fruitful part, though. To be fruitful means to really multiply.
Oh, so you're saying, well, you could have one or two, but if you have 50, then you're in. You know, welcome to China. Could be. I don't know. Could be. I've never seen that commentary, but I'm willing to hold in. Let's take what some of you are saying and see what we do with it. I want to give you a couple of perceptions. And I want you to remember, to bear in mind, that the original theme, the underlying question that we asked yesterday, which is going to accompany us through these classes, right, is the question of the development of Jewish identity. Somehow this story is a part of the process of the 70 sons of Jacob, the family of Yaakov, becoming the nation of Israel. And I want to understand that. Why is that necessary? What's going on? So I want to tell you a couple of things. First of all, it becomes clear from the continuation of the story that this story of these Hebrew midwives ultimately leads to the birth of Moshe. So we're talking about the period in Egyptian slavery that's all the way at the other end of the slavery. In other words, I've got the beginning of the slavery when they come down, however much time exists until they become enslaved. And then I've got the end of the period when Moshe is born until Moses finally comes back and becomes the Messiah, the Redeemer, whatever, right? It's interesting, by the way, that the Torah does not tell me that much about the period in the middle. There must have been some incredible stories in the slavery of Egypt. Look how much literature has been written on the Holocaust, which is a period of 12 years. This is a period of 200 years. It kind of gives you the idea that the Torah is not a book of history. That's not the purpose of Torah. I may glean history from the Torah, but that's not the purpose of Torah. Right? And therefore, the Torah will devote tremendous efforts, time, and content space to a day, such as the whole book of Deuteronomy, which according to most commentaries is one day, the final soliloquy speech of Moshe, which he gave an entire day, and give you 3, 4, 5, 10 verses on a 200-year period. What's going on here? There are some fascinating ideas here. And I would suggest that what you can find here is a process which will become important in Jewish history. I would suggest even that this process is worth being aware of in as much as that it has the ability to affect me today. Look what goes on here. The Jewish people have come down to Egypt. They're in Egypt, as we mentioned yesterday, because of a certain insensitivity, brother to brother. Look at the first human act that is expressed as the dawn of redemption, the beginnings of the end of this circle, which will see them ultimately out of Egypt. It's the sensitivity of a human being for their fellow. And look at this sensitivity. The brothers sitting on the pit, listening to Joseph cry, had every reason to be sensitive. It was mind-boggling that they weren't sensitive. This was their brother. They were taking a tremendous risk. They were going to pay a price with Jacob, with their father. Here, these midwives, interestingly enough, have all the motivation to be insensitive. And yet somehow they are able to rise above that and to be sensitive. It is this act, when you think about it, that is the beginning of the redemption of the Jewish people. That's not random. That's very important. It tells me that in order to achieve redemption, in order to move the world towards a better place, it has to be founded on my sensitivity to my fellow human being. And you will hear this from me again and again, because I believe that you will not look anywhere in Judaism and anywhere in the Torah and not find this. Now look what happens. And by the way, since you mentioned this, look in verse 17. This is a very important verse. V'tir'ena ha'miyaldot et ha'elohim. These midwives are called Ivriim, Ivriot, right? They're called Hebrews. I mentioned yesterday, I think, that that's not the term that we use for Jews. That's the Egyptian term. That's the Canaanite term. And whenever the Bible uses that term, it signifies the fact that someone else is viewing us that way. Because the word Ivri comes from the word Aver, which means over there, the other side. Aver HaYarden is the other side of the Jordan River. And these women are over there. They're like different. We actually, well, whatever. So now look what happens. How do you translate this verse? And I have to be honest with you, if you feel a certain pang or a frustration as I translate this verse, that's good. You can do a tremendous amount of Torah study in English. But you have to realize that you are always going to be missing something. That doesn't mean that a person doesn't have the opportunity to discover tremendous beauty in Torah in English. Today there are tremendous, tremendous texts and commentaries and authorities that are translated into English. But you'll always be missing something. It's not random that the Jewish people chose, consciously and subconsciously, to revive an ancient language of Hebrew for their modern state, because it is one of the things that binds us to our heritage. This is going to be a good example. If you look at the English translation, it says, "Vatir'ena ha'mialdot et Elohim," and they feared God. And because they feared God, they didn't do that which the king spoke to them. And they allowed the children, the babies, to live. And if you read that verse, it seems almost as though they have a choice. They have this fear of God, whatever God is, and they have this fear of Pharaoh. You'd have to be an idiot not to fear Pharaoh. And so they balance them. And because their fear of God is greater than their fear of Pharaoh, so that's why they choose to allow the children to live. And I could give you a great speech on it. I could give you a great class on it. If we could only develop a level where our fear of God is so great that it overcomes everything else, that'd be tremendous. Now that'd be a great class, except it's completely wrong. And I have to be honest with you, it took me a long time to realize how wrong this is. Now, I'm not saying it's totally wrong. It could be that it's partially right. And it could be that it's my perception that it's wrong. There are others who translate it this way, and they view it as right. So I can only share with you my perception. But what does the word vatir'ena really mean? And this is what people miss. This is the word in Hebrew. Okay? Vatir, I may be spelling it with a yod, vatir'ena. Okay? And everybody translates this as fear. In fact, there's an incredible statement in the Talmud. Hakol bidei shamayim, all is in the hands of heaven. Chutz mi yirat shamayim, except for the yirah of heaven. And everybody translate that, the fear of God. Your fear of God is dependent on you, not on God. Let's imagine for the moment that that word is not properly translated, and that it's a totally different word. What word do you think it would be? What other word, for those of you who know a little Hebrew, do you see in that word? To see. Did you ever hear the word lirot, to see? In fact, that's the word. To see. Now look back at that verse and imagine that that's what this word means. Vatir'ena ha'mialdot et Elohim. They saw God. And because they saw God, they couldn't possibly put those children to death. Now, consider this for just one more moment before we go on. What does it mean then when the Talmud tells me, Hakol bidei shamayim, chutz mi yirat shamayim? All is in the hands of heaven except for the yirah of heaven, the perception of heaven. In other words, my relationship with God is not supposed to be based on fear. Fear is a very human emotion. In fact, you will not find a word in the Torah for fear. You'll find the word in Hebrew, lefached, pachad, is fear. You won't find that in the Torah, to the best of my knowledge. Because that isn't real. Any word, maybe I have to preface this for one moment, because this is very important. And it's very important in terms of the study of Torah. I told you that while we're doing this, occasionally we're going to come across moments where we can actually express a rule of methodology in Torah study. So here comes one. I told you a couple, first read, then learn, ask questions, study partners, here's another one. At the beginning of the Torah, God decides, for whatever the reason, to create the world. So what does God do? God says, "Vayomer Elohim yehi or." And God said, "Let there be light." Right? You may have heard this verse before. "Vayehi or," and there was light. So I have this image. What's my image? Right? That there's this thing we call God, and I have no idea what it is, but there's this thing called God, Hashem. And Hashem says, "Let there be light." And all of a sudden, there was light. The Kabbalah teaches us that that's not really true. See, it doesn't say in the verse, and God said, "Let there be light," and then, and there was light. See, it doesn't say that middle thing. It just says, and God said, "Let there be light." The act of creation of Hashem was somehow the act of speech. How did God create the light? He said light. That was the creation of light. Now, that's very difficult. Because my concept of saying something is a very physical concept. And at least within Judaism, the definition of God is that God is aphysical. Because by definition, a physical being is limited. The minute something is physical, it has boundaries. It's here and it's not there. And if my definition of God is that God is unlimited, then God can't be physical. Maimonides discusses that. And if God can't be physical, then the speech of God can't be speech the way I understand it. So let's assume for the moment that this concept of creation that we call saying is very difficult for me to understand. It's fair to assume I would have some difficulty understanding how God created the world. That's fair. But let's assume that somehow the concept of speech is the closest thing that I can find within my imagination in this world to develop a relationship with that concept. Does that make sense? What's important to me, though, is that if the process of creation of God is through the Word, and this is a Kabbalistic idea, then the Word, in fact, contains everything about that creation. In other words, everything about or light is to be found in the word or. Now, I'm not going to go into how that works, because that gets very deep, and it's very beautiful. And the more you study Hebrew, and the more you study the beauty of the letters and the beauty of the words, the more you learn about the world. It's tremendous. It's not like normal language the way we understand it. But I will tell you a couple of examples just to give you an idea. Because if in fact God creates the world through the Word, then there are some very interesting phenomena to take note of. For example, if a word doesn't appear in the Torah, it's because it wasn't created by God. Because everything created by God is somehow to be found in the Torah, because the Torah tells me that God created the world. So sometimes, if I know that I can't find a word in the Torah, that tells me that it's not real. It's an illusion. It's man-made. I'll give you an example. The word safek, which is the Hebrew word for doubt. Now, you will find this word all over the Talmud. In safek motzi mizdei vadai, if someone has a doubt, he can't take property from someone who knows that it's his. Right? Sfek sfeka, the concept of a double doubt. All over the Talmud you find this. All over halacha, all over Jewish law. You will not find this word anywhere in the Torah. You know why? Because doubt isn't real. God didn't create doubt. I did. And what I create isn't real. Unless it's in partnership with God. That's a phenomenal idea. What is doubt? How could God create doubt? Why would there be doubt? God created it. It is. I have doubts. Because I don't know if it's real. I'll give you another example. The word teva, tet bet ayin, is the Hebrew word for nature. And you find this all over the commentaries. The balance of nes and teva, miracle and nature. And yet you will not find the word teva anywhere in the Torah. You know why? Because the word teva of nature is not real. What does that mean, nature? It's as if to say that there is miracle and there is nature. But that's not real. See, when I look at the world, I may imagine that there's nature and there's God. I'm driving on my way to work, and I say, look, God, do me a favor. I have a very important lecture to give, very important meeting. My kids are waiting for me for whatever. Do me a favor. Don't get in the way. Just let things run their course. Don't make a traffic accident. Don't create traffic. Don't do whatever. Just do me a favor. Let things work out the way they are. That's how some people view the balance between God and nature. But what that means really is that I have this perception that there's nature, and then there's God, and God can step in and influence nature, but God is outside of nature. Some people perceive that God created the world and the laws of nature, and then nature runs its course, and God sort of sits back and watches. It may well be that it's a much higher level of faith, and I'm not going to get into this right now, to understand that nature is God. That if God created the world, then all of the world is God and all of reality is God. And that I can see God in everything in nature. That I look at a tree and at a flower and at a bug and at a bird and at my fingernail and I can find God. Now why do I tell you all this? Because if that's true, then the concept of nature as being different from God, which is what the word teva really means, right? That concept is somewhat of an illusion in the Torah, and perhaps that's why the word teva isn't in nature. Now, why do I share this with you? Give me a minute. Because it's interesting that the word pachad is not in the Torah either. Fear. Why? Perhaps. Because fear is something that comes from me. It's not something that God created. When you stop to think about it, if I could really develop a relationship with God that was so incredible and so constant that I didn't for a moment forget that I have this relationship, then how could I ever be afraid? I mean, those of you who were at my lecture last night. So we spoke about the balance between struggling with my own reality and having afterwards the perspective of faith that once I've done my bit and done my struggle, that somehow it'll work out. So if that's so, how could I ever be afraid? Because if I'm doing my bit, it'll work out somehow. So I'm not suggesting for the moment that everybody here should feel that way. And I'm not even suggesting for the moment that anybody here has an idea of my perception of how it works. But it's very interesting that that's not what the word yirah means. The word yirah means to see. See, what's happened here is that these Jews, in the depth of Egypt, in the darkness of the night, have a relationship with God that allows them to perceive the presence of this force being great love, even in the darkness of Egypt. Now that's an unbelievable thing. It's no big deal to find God sitting up on the rooftop of Israelite on Shavuot morning, when tens of thousands of Jews are streaming in from all over the city into the old city. But if you can find God in the furnaces of Auschwitz, well, that's something way beyond most of our comprehension. That's what's going on here. That's an unbelievable thing. And that's why that verse is so important. It's because in order to be able to resist evil, in order to be able to find your path, you have to try to find that relationship. It has to become a part of you. It has to become an awareness that you have. That's a magnificent thing. So that's thought number one. Let me just, I just want to finish one more thought. Okay, and then if anybody has questions, I'll have a few minutes. Second thought is something to be aware of. I'm going to open up a thought process, which I'm not going to finish. And I'll tell you why I'm going to do that. Because if you finish this class, I've opened up this thought process for you, and then you say, okay, I've got to pursue this, and I've whet your appetite, then I'll be very happy. I wouldn't have done anything if I started an issue, closed it, you walked away and said, that's nice. But if you have a desire to pursue this, then you're learning, so that's great. So here's an interesting perception. Look what's going on here. This is the first time in history, to my knowledge, certainly in the Torah, where I find anti-Semitism. Think about it. And look at the stages of anti-Semitism, because somebody, I think Rebecca, asked the question very well. This doesn't make any sense. First of all, there are tens, hundreds of thousands of Jews. How could they become slaves? But I'll go a stage further. Why would they want to become slaves? Why would Pharaoh want to enslave them? Can you imagine if Pharaoh had actually embraced them? And if you look at Pharaoh's argument, there seems to be almost an inherent illogic in what's going on here. So I want to share with you the process. Did you come up with this? Is that right? Yeah.
That was my issue.
Okay, so then we're learning Torah. We're on the same wavelength. So let's see, okay, if we came up with the same things, and you add what I don't get to, okay? First of all, I want to tell you, look what happens here. Where's the first process, at least according to the Torah, of the beginning of anti-Semitism? What verse? Now that's what everybody says. And you're right, but you're also not right. Now I didn't say you're wrong, but I wonder maybe if it doesn't really begin in verse 7. There's an unbelievable verse here. U'bnei Yisrael paru v'yishretzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'ma'od ma'od. Now that's a very powerful verse. And I will translate only one or two of the words. It really means that they multiply, but there's so many adjectives. And remember what we said. If this book, if I'm giving a speech and I'm writing a speech, so then it's considered nice if I can say that the Jewish people were fine and they were brave and they were strong and they were magnificent. And I'm saying all these different adjectives because it lends character to the statement. But if this is a divine book, if it's written by God, right, and I said, don't accept that, but at least let's imagine it, then why do I need all these adjectives? Doesn't make sense, unless I learn something from it. So the Maharal, 16th century Kabbalistic mystic philosopher commentary, lived in Prague, says a very interesting thing. What does it mean, vayishritzu? Right? Paru means that they were fruitful, from the word pri, fruit. What does it mean, vayishritzu? The root of the word vayishritzu is a sheretz. You know what a sheretz is? It's a lizard. They multiplied like lizards, like bugs. It's a creepy, crawly thing. They became like creepy qualities. It's not exactly a wonderful adjective. I bless you that you should have children like the ants in the field. I don't know if I would say that under a chuppah. You should become like cockroaches in a sewer. It just, you know, it wouldn't invite me back. But that's what this means. So the Maharal says, this is really the beginning of the problem. Because the Jewish people were in Egypt, but they were in Egypt. And they were becoming influenced by Egyptian culture. They were somehow falling into the morass, the gutter, if you will, of paganism and idolatry. And if you look at the end of the verse, it makes even more sense. It says, "Vatimalei ha'aretz otam." Now, what this is translated as is, "and they filled the land." Literally what it means was the land filled them. "Vatimalei ha'aretz," and the land filled otam, them. They became full of Egypt. They became more Egyptian than the Egyptians. In fact, it's interesting that one commentary that I once read says, why did Pharaoh have to go to the midwives in order to find the Jewish babies? Why didn't he just go to all the Jews, take them out, grab the babies, and do what he did? Because you couldn't recognize the Jews anymore. There's a Zohar, there's a Book of Splendor comment that suggests that the Jewish people had sunk to the 49th level of impurity. In other words, they were so deeply rooted in Egypt that if they didn't get out soon, they'd never get out. Tremendous idea. And interestingly enough, that's always the beginning of anti-Semitism. And perhaps what the Torah is telling us, and this is really deep and Kabbalistic, is that if you study the story, you will discover the story of Jewish history and anti-Semitism. Now, I will say what I'm about to say on the condition that nobody assumes, in any way, shape, or form, that what I'm saying is any kind of explanation. Because we can't explain these things. It's not even, God forbid, an opinion. But it's very interesting to note that in modern history, every period of anti-Semitism has been preceded by an intense period of assimilation. And the best example I can think of is Germany. Because the German Jews really believed that they were Germans first, or many of them. Some of them. Something was dreadfully wrong. It can't happen here. Not in the land of Germany, in the land of Bach, and Beethoven, and Mozart. Can't be. We're Germans. We fought in World War I. Almost as if they were full of Germany. And then comes the next stage. We know the Kaiser. We fought for him. We love him, and he loves us. But Vayakam Melech Chadash, there will be a new king. Asher lo yadat Yosef, who did not know Joseph. And the rabbis suggest, the question is not whether the old king died and a new one was born. It's that this king all of a sudden doesn't remember who Joseph is. It could be the same person. How many times have we seen this happen in history? The same person all of a sudden doesn't know who we are. It's a very frightening thought. And how many times have we seen that happen? And then, Vayomer Elamo, Hinei Am B'nei Yisrael. Now this is an unbelievable thing, because this is the first time in the Torah that we are called an Am, a nation. Do you know who labels us a nation? They do. Egypt. God doesn't call us an Am. Moses doesn't call us an Am. Pharaoh does. Almost as if to say, if you forget who you are, I will send you a Pharaoh to remind you who you are. It's a very frightening thought. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me. My relationship with God, my love for the land of Israel, is not based on the fact that I'm afraid that some Pharaoh is going to come along and do whatever again. That's not what I'm saying. As a matter of fact, I think that's a lower level to reach. It's a much higher level to come to the land of Israel because you love Israel than it is to come to Israel because you're afraid of what will happen in America. But at the same time, it's a valuable process to be aware of. That's almost as if what the Torah is telling me is, you forgot your mission, I'll remind you of your mission. How many times have we seen this happen? There has never been a country where the Jews could stay eternally. Because if they forget who they are, they get reminded. And the most fascinating stage of this, and here we have to stop almost, is the process which Pharaoh uses. First of all, what's his fear? Pain your bed, lest they become too many. Verse 10. And when there'll be a war, he'll join our enemies, fight us, and leave the land. That's what he says, right? He says, we got to do something, because there's so many of them. What if we get attacked and they join our enemy? And then they'll overcome us, and they'll leave the land. Makes no sense. What should they do if they overcome us? They should stay. It's almost as though it's illogical. Go a stage further. What's the best way to ensure that they don't overcome us by joining our enemy? Make them happy. What's the best way to ensure that they do join our enemy? Enslave them. It makes no sense. 3,000 years later, a man with a mustache would make the same mistake. When you look at World War II from a strategic, historical perspective, it's really amazing. Hitler really should have won the war. He really should have. Anti-Semitism is an illogical thing. One of the most dangerous things that we can do is to try to analyze anti-Semitism logically, if you stop to think about it. I understand it. There was a reason for it. What if it's not logical? Now again, if this is, and if all of this is random, and if there is no force, no reason, no purpose to our being, so forget about for the moment how depressing that would be to me personally, then nothing I'm saying makes sense. But if there is a purpose and a meaning somehow, then it stands to reason that that being the case, that all of this fits within that plan. And if it does, when I look at all of these instances of anti-Semitism, it really doesn't make sense. Sometimes there's a tremendous value in life to being able to say, you know what, there's certain things I cannot understand. I cannot understand anti-Semitism. I've read books on this topic, trying to analyze the causes of anti-Semitism. There was a whole flux of written material that came out after the Holocaust. How could people have done this? And you begin to sense in the reading that there's this intense scrambling to find some theological underpinning in order to put it into a box. And no one can do it. What if, and I don't presume to have the answer, what if it doesn't make sense? What if it's illogical? What if it's a whole different way of looking at it? It puts a whole different perspective on it. Almost as if Hashem says, you cannot understand. And don't think that I'm about to say, God forbid, that God creates anti-Semitism and that that gets us back to Israel and that's the reason for the Holocaust. God forbid. I would never be so arrogant. But understand, on the other hand, that if somehow there's a goal, and if I look back at 2,000 years and I start to see now in our day that perhaps we're actually reaching that goal, I can look back at the events in history and begin to wonder, did I ever have a way of understanding that whole process? And then look at the last stage, what Paro does. Vayasimu alav sarim misim, right? The most important verse, verse 13. Vayavidu Mitzrayim et b'nei Yisrael befarech. And the Egyptians did cause the Jews to undergo their servitude befarech. Now, farech is translated as hard labor. But the rabbis do a play on the words and say you could actually read it. In the Torah, there are no vowels. You could actually read it as perach, which means a soft mouth. In other words, there are two forms that anti-Semitism can take. And this is a comment that's written about 2,000 years ago. It can be the farech, it can be the hard labor. It can be the perach, it can be the soft mouth. And the Medrash says an unbelievable thing. It says first, the Egyptians decided they were afraid. Were they going to take 600,000, 3 million people and put them into slave camps? It won't work. Let's do it little by little. First we'll tell them, we're going to start, you know, there's unemployment, we're going to have a big national building plan. And we'll give great wages, and everybody will come work for us. And that works. And then a little while after that, they say, okay, we don't have enough money to continue the project, but you know, Egypt, nationality, do it for the country, we have to lower your wages, but it's important. So everybody says, okay, we're going to pitch in for Egypt, and they all get into it. And they say, you know, we really don't have that much money, we're passing a law that we don't have to pay you until we can fill our coffers, but it's a national service law, you have to continue to work. It's important, servitude, country, loyalty, flag. And then gradually, not only is there no pay, but there are taskmasters. And then gradually the taskmasters are given whips. And before they know it, all of a sudden the Jews find themselves behind barbed wire. I want to tell you that the Book of Splendor has a much deeper idea and says that this is the process of our own enslavement. One of the beauties of Torah is how multi-level it is. How do I enslave myself? The same ferach. I beat myself the same way until finally I find myself surrounded by barbed wire. I do things that make a lot of sense. And as I gradually lose the logic behind the process that I'm in, and I find that my lifestyle is almost a form of enslavement, a limitation, I'm too much in to get out. And that's also the depth of Torah. So now there are tremendous processes to be aware of. This is the first stage in the development of the Jewish people. As if to say, you have a challenge, you have a gift, an opportunity to fall in love with your Jewish identity, to discover what it means. But God, Torah, is also telling the Jewish people, realize, if you don't discover the meaning, I'll find a way to give you that meaning. Easy or hard, because that's a meaning that's too important for the world to lose. That's a very powerful idea. That's the beginning of Shemot. It is not accidental that we become a Jewish nation because someone else has to remind us that we're a Jewish nation. I would venture to suggest Jabotinsky, and I'm not talking politics, Jabotinsky was very right-wing, you can agree, you can disagree. Some consider Vladimir Jabotinsky to have been a prophet. I don't go quite that far out on a limb. But you do get the sense from his writings that he had a certain vision. He went around the community of Europe as late as 1931, and he begged people to listen to him. Come home. We have a country. We can build a nation. Come home. We need you. Your place is not here. Come back. They will never love you, these peoples. And people laughed at him. And 12 years later, all those who laughed at him were gone. And 3 years after that, we had a state. And again, I stress this, I don't want anybody to walk out of here with a misimpression. There is no way that a human being living in our lifetime, in this world, can possibly attempt to fathom what we call the Holocaust, much less Jewish history. So that's not what I'm saying. But sometimes God puts A next to B and says, listen, you're not going to understand this, but at least wake up and look at it. That the Holocaust, which was one of the most significant events in the last 2,000 years to the Jewish people, occurred a scant 3 years before the rise of the State of Israel, which was another of the most significant events of the Jewish people in the last 2,000 years. It would be mind-boggling to me, on the other hand, to imagine that it's coincidental. I can't understand it, but it's there. I got to do something with it. So that's a challenge. What do I learn from that? If someone takes that challenge and decides that he has to go and tell everybody else what to do with it, he's missed the boat. But if someone takes that challenge and says, what is that going to mean to me? What do I gain from that? How is that going to change me as a human being? Then he's developing a relationship with Torah. And that's the challenge.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.